Hello and welcome to another of our live in lockdown podcasts. This is the Tortoise Shack. We are missing Caroline. We're missing Rachel. Caroline has an assignment in, and Rachel is currently actually trying to download her own podcast. So, you know, we stay busy in the Tortoise Shack. We are exceptionally busy. We're delighted to be joined in his new lair, in his new mobile lair, by actor, writer, poet. Emmett Kirwan. Emmett, how are you?
Yeah, good. I started moving house 2.5 months ago. And the moving van was supposed to come the day after. It was around lockdown time. So we moved into a new house with no furniture, and we couldn't get any of the furniture until this week. The guy came and got it all in the van and came up to us, you know.
But, I wanted to open by saying, first and foremost, that I'm coming up on, actually, take Martin out of it, I'm coming up on nearly 500 podcasts recorded. And there are certain people that when you meet them and you talk to them, you feel like starting the revolution afterwards. There's, you know, Lynn Rowan, I think of Grace Dias, I think of Maeve O'Rourke, I think of Sinead Mercier, but none of them were available. So we ended up with our fifth choice on the list.
Coca-Cola Championship of artists. I don't know football, but I don't know.
Can I ask whatever
League 2 used to be, or 4 now.
Emmett, in terms of the actual most recent piece you've put out, it was from last year, and it's from Temple Bar, and it's The City Is Not Dead. And there was an eerie silence to that now, hearing it and understanding that the city is dead. But we want to talk about the arts. What state are we in? Are the arts currently on life support?
They were kind of on life support even before, you know, this, going into this. There had been in the Fine Gael leadership contest, there was a commitment from both leaders to improve or increase the amount of funding. And there was a 7% year-on-year increase to the arts that was supposed to happen. That never happened. So already there was an action plan as well, a 10-year action plan that was supposed to take us to 2025. And we only got a look at that this year, 5 years into, you know, an action plan that was supposed to be, that was muted in 2016, and was only kind of, we've only got to look at it now. And again, it was kind of just a vague, kind of loose understanding towards what we will do, kind of like what the government formation talks are at the moment. But the one good thing about it is there's a new artistic director of the Arts Council, and the Arts Council are really doing a lot, like, with a very constrained budget. And everybody was kind of doing a lot with constrained budgets, but there's a lot of new people now in the Arts Council. And so, you know, I hope it's going to change for artists over the last number of years. After the crash, we started to get kind of asked to do things for free. And the Arts Council had just done this new kind of campaign about, you know, having to pay the artists is one of the main things, you know.
Yeah, it's a very good point, because we've lived in this culture of, you know, you're doing it for the profile, you're doing it for the recognition, and sure, just give us your time. And, you know, even Martin will remember, even when we started with the artwork of on our original podcast with Kira Kenny, did it. One of the main things was saying to her, look, you know, how much is it? We have no money coming in, but we'll buy the thing. And they're going, look, but I really like what you're doing. You're going, yeah, but your work has value. And if we don't actually preach that, then, you know, people take advantage.
Well, it's funny, you know, it's something, whenever I'm talking to students that are in film school, or, you know, drama students, or, you know, when I'm doing a class, because I teach as well, and I'd always say, you know, the different types of capital, and I'm sure you guys, we've talked about this before, you know, and the social capital that you gain in college is something that you can rely on when you leave college in order to gain cultural capital. So you can get your friends to work for free, you know, on your first film or your first play, and when you start to accrue that cultural capital, then you can possibly maybe start to turn that cultural capital into financial capital. That third step doesn't always happen for people. It kind of stops really at the social capital or personal capital that you kind of gain. But after a while, you can only, and I always say this to, you know, people who are starting out, if you're making your third short film and you're still not paying your crew and they're your friends, they're going to start getting annoyed, you know? So you usually get one kind of shake, two shakes of kind of getting your friends to all kind of rally together, because they all get something out of it. And usually as well, if they're all at the same age group and they're all at the same age profile and stuff and they're all starting out, it's beneficial to everybody. But what happened was, unfortunately, in the last crash prior to 2008, if you got two writers in a room, and I was in my 20s at the time, I have drank loads of water today and I still have this voice. I don't know.
It's a long-term thing at this stage, Emmett.
Still sound like I have been drinking sandpaper, liquid sandpaper. Well, you used to, like, let's say two writers in a room, for example, you get paid 200 quid for the day for sitting down and writing something. And that was just even for development, because there was so much money around, and people kind of understood that when two writers sat down, they'd give you money. And then the crash happened and people would be like, okay, look, you know, it's a different time. We'll pay you when we get paid. And I think artists kind of understood that. They knew, you know, okay, we can enter into a creative process or something with the hope that at the end of this, we'll get money from whatever kind of funding organization or whatever producer is going to do it. But what happened is that culture of non-payment to all artists, and I mean, you know, from writers to sculptors to musicians, especially musicians and around festivals and stuff like that, that culture kind of started creeping further and further and further into the so-called, you know, economic recovery. You were still getting asked to show up and work for free even in 2017, 2018. And you're kind of getting asked by companies that had huge successes as well, you know, so they would think that paying you 50 quid was an insult, but not realizing that paying you zero is more an insult. Do you know what I mean? Like, so there was a tacit understanding of, well, you'll get a big payday if you kind of keep working for free. But often what happens with development, and especially around the arts, the money doesn't come, and then you've given like a year and a half like working for free, you know. So, and it's hard as well when you're coming out, because you want to gain that cultural capital. And what I always say to young artists is, look, you can't pay your rent with you know, exposure.
Yeah. No,
so that's where the arts doesn't survive then the arts in major cities doesn't survive. So I suppose, looping back to what you're talking about that Temple Bar thing, you know, it all starts with art and then it ends in real estate. Arts thrives in times like now, you know, when there's no money, there's empty buildings in the crash, you know, artists move into these areas, they revitalize these areas. But then what happens is they make buildings and areas that were not viable previously viable again. They make them cultural hubs.
To make them
then
vibrant.
Tourists start to come in. And then what happens is the person that sat on the property for 30 years all of a sudden has a viable piece of real estate again. And the artists get turfed out, as is the case in Smithfield and, you know, Temple Bar. And, happened ad infinitum all over the world. Hoxton,
that is the gentrification process. And we've seen it.
Yeah.
And we've seen it wash, rinse and repeat. And that's the issue. And now
it's a horrible thing. But yeah, people think it's a good, it's weird because as politicians think it's a good thing. You know what I mean? They're like, you know, I heard a politician say recently, and he meant well by it, you know, he's a nice man. He said, we sold an arch under something in London. And he said, they made some sort of cultural hub or something like that. But then the two arches either side went for millions. And I was like, but that's exactly what, you know, so what happens is the place, it's called, you know, they become then places of experience culture. So previously that arts building is now a Supermax, or not a Supermax, that's unfair to them, like, but you know, it's a
mayor's house in Bray, the center turned into a McDonald's like 20 odd years ago or something like that. There's all of these famous McDonald's examples of buildings that became Starbucks.
Well, Temple Bar, like, you know, there was like a lot of, there's a, you know, owner, you know, small kind of mom and pop operations. And but the poem, I suppose, the moment that it was last week, was, you know, Temple Bar, July, whatever. And it was a companion piece to the piece that I was doing for the Abbey that was going out last week as well. So the two of them were kind of Temple Bar 6 months ago. And then the other one was Temple Bar. I started writing it about 6 weeks ago, what was happening in Temple Bar at that time, you know, kind of living in Tampa Bar in lockdown was pretty crazy. And I was actually there before I got out, just as the lockdown happened, kind of moved down. And I was in it like for one day, one night. And the city, yeah, it's quite mad, you know, now how Tampa Bar has transformed, you know.
Just, I suppose, then we looked at what's happened, and I was talking to a lot of other actors and comedians and all who are really, like, all gigs are cancelled. It's very hard. You know, I know the Dublin Improv are doing their Monday Night Improvs on Zoom now.
Yeah.
So if anybody's interested, you know, you can throw them the price of a cup of coffee on a Ko-fi account. And
that sounds like fun.
Yeah. I mean, like, it was only ever a fiver in anyway, but like, they're trying to, like, these people, they might have relied on that that few bob on the Monday evening as well. So, like, all of those things. But it's about trying to find that balance in this new reality. Are you finding that, like, you know, as a writer, that at least there's work coming, but as a performer, that's the end of that?
Yeah, as a writer, it's, you know, it's shifting. Everybody's kind of shifting to, like, well, what can we do? What can we make? And funny enough, I'm getting more work now since this has happened, you know, because people are trying to figure out creative ways to try and make things happen, you know. And, you know, people will run out of things after a while, but it's to watch and consume. So new art has to be created, even in this situation. So there's a drive to kind of, some people think that the art should just kind of go into a type of deep freeze where everybody kind of locks themselves down, writes, prepares, and then comes out the gate as soon as kind of, whenever this is over, if it's a vaccine, because I was doing a Q&A last night. Excuse me. They showed Dublin Old School and there was a Q&A. And afterwards they were saying it was an art centre and they were saying they had 250 seats. But if they open with social distancing, it would be reduced down, I think, to 75 seater or something like that. So it was almost unviable, you know what I mean? Well, I can't remember what the word is. Yeah. Not viable. Yeah, so, you know, it's like for cinemas, for theatres, whatever about the audience, it's about what would performers do. You know, art galleries obviously can reopen and you can have social distancing. There's lots of arts, libraries, hopefully, you know what I mean? But it will be limited, you know what I mean, like in the space. But in terms of performances, live performance, where people are going to have to get creative. I know Carlo Arts are doing something really creative for their Carlo Arts Festival. Theirs is going on this in 2-3 months time. But it's there's one idea they have about like 3D mapping the room that the person's in with an app on their phone, and then they're going to do like an 8D soundscape. You know, have you ever seen those 8D soundscape things on YouTube? You put the headphones on and
yeah, it's like an immersion, like type thing.
Yeah, so like, you know, people are going to start getting creative in that sense. Sorry, I'm pressing something here. People are going to start getting creative in that sense. But I think in terms of live theatre, it's going to be a death knell for a lot of kind of places, you know?
Yeah. Martin, you wanted to come in.
Yeah, Emmett, sorry, congratulations on your new place, Emmett. Well done. And I hope in Dublin 4 they appreciate you.
Oh, no,
I was going to ask.
He's in Bray.
I'm in undisclosed location.
That I can see the waltzers in the background.
See, this is kind of new. They're all my fiance's shoes up the top of the wardrobe, and then, you know, people front about their thing.
Yeah, have you got your Nazi book in the background? No,
but yeah, that's yeah.
You're Michael Gove. Martin. Sorry.
That's it. It's a lot of graphic novels. Sorry, go on, Martin.
Oh, he's gone.
Is he? No,
I'm back. And I'm back. Thank you very much. Emmett, I'll jump in because that was just breaking up on me all over the place. Is this situation kind of, and I've been trying to think of it from an arts point of view, is this like the mobile phone in that everything before the mobile phone is now going to seem really dated, whereas everything before this epidemic is going to seem dated, and everything beyond this epidemic has to include this epidemic or else it's going to be dated?
I know what you mean, yeah. I'm not so... I think cataclysmic events usually kind of... They don't feature in as much of popular culture as people think they would. You know what I mean? Like, going forward, like, there's many things, you know what I mean? Depending, I suppose, in the sense that this is a worldwide thing. A lot of American art, you know, referenced 9/11. There was pre-9/11 and post-9/11. But, like, you know, then people would actually make art that won't, you know what I mean, reference it at all. But certainly, I don't know, you know what I mean? Like, did the Spanish flu have as kind of a lasting effect on the consciousness of art and artists as
what this did? I was thinking if this lasts, if there's no...
Oh, sorry, I thought you meant like how would it affect them, like, you know, the way mobile phones pop up in pieces of art or...
But I mean, from the creative process, if you're going to write from here on in, is it really a case that you get ready to come out of the starting gates, or do you just have to deal with it the way it is and write it the way it is?
It's kind of weird. The TV show I did for RT a few years ago, Sarah and Steve, because that was lo-fi and kind of just like this, it was like video diaries, that's kind of been muted as being a kind of thing that we could do, and we've been figuring out a way of doing it. So the camera crew would be outside the house, I mean, shooting in to me, and then the other actress, you know, just kind of like, so people are going to try and figure out how to do all of these things and do them. But I think, I don't know if I have an answer to your question, Martin. I'm not sure what's going to happen. You know what I mean? I really don't. You know what I mean? Like, I think, you know, there will be a bottleneck of art if everybody has like multiple projects that are all ready to go, and also scarce resources. So not everything's going to get funded. You know what I mean? And what kind of art will get funded over what will be a whole, what gets funded and what doesn't, you know what I mean? But what gets precedence.
Going back to how the shape of it, like we've seen the, you know, the cultural space is shrinking. We've still seen planning permission, looking for an eight floor hotel in the Liberties again, you know, in the last week. We're still seeing that, and you know, we're supposed to still call it progress. Is there, you know, there is an opportunity in this, or you say there will be a bottleneck of creativity that has to come out somewhere. Do you see any hope in that?
I do. I think people are going to get a lot more creative. You know, a lot of anxiety, and a lot of, and that anxiety feeds into the art. So, you know, it depends. The kind of idea around productivity is the thing that really drives people crazy. So, I was promising myself I wouldn't get political about this. So it was the kind of the response to it was like, you know, here's a lot of money, go make a TikTok video. You know, the kind of way, like, but the idea really is that if artists are to go into kind of a deep freeze kind of moment, they can take their time. You know, it's not about kind of if you wake up and you don't make something, you don't make it, because what's happened a lot and what happens with kind of government funding and the idea that governments have of the arts is we've internalized market values for the arts. So it's about bums on seats. It's about, well, what does this hope to achieve? What are your goals for the art? As opposed to, oh, you just want to make some art. Grand. And also, there needs to be what's happened is something we touched on earlier. Artists have essentially become form fillers, looking for money from, you know, institutions. So you're dedicating like months, weeks, you know, to filling out a form in order to get a small amount of money that will take you through one project. And unfortunately, what's happened is in the arts in this country, there's project funding. So before, people would have arts or funding for about 2 or 3 years, kind of the way you would think any funding was, you know, funding for a healthcare system, for example, if you can budget for 12 or 24 or, you know, 3 years time ahead of time, you can make plans about what you're going to produce and take your time on what you're going to produce. But what's happened is, you have to apply for every project, and you have to like take 6 or 7 weeks to apply to the Arts Council, which is a bureaucracy. They have to account for every penny, but you almost have to turn on another skill of being a form filler, you know, and figure out how to get this cash, get this money from the Arts Council, you know?
Yeah.
So if there was some kind of, I don't know, universal basic income for the artists to simply work and do what they're doing. But, you know, I have a problem as a socialist with that as well, because, you know, I'm thinking if you're going to give it to artists, you need to give it to everybody, you know? Mm. You know, because there's a lot of time that this kind of conversation happens, like they say, when art can't survive in cities like Dublin or London, you know, art can't survive in the free market. It just gets eaten up. So the only people that can actually take part in it are people who either are from that city have parents that are from that city or have parents that can bankroll them.
Patronage. It can become a patronage model. And that we've seen that in journalism, we've seen that in arts, and we've seen it, sadly, in lots of places. I see Colette Bennett is saying to give UBI to everyone, and that is probably the only way to make it work. It has to be universal.
This is what I was saying about, like, kind of, because I remember someone trying to say, the point I was going to make was, someone said, you know, maybe give public housing to artists. It was like, no, we can't do that. You know, artists are workers. They earn about 8,000 to 15,000 euros a year. They are kind of a beggar class, or have been reduced to a kind of beggar class. But we sound like politicians, but we don't make the type of money they make. We get invited to their parties and we get to hang out with them, but we are financially, socioeconomically, not in the same bracket as them. But for some reason, we've convinced ourselves that we are. And so, you know, if you want like UBI or social or public housing, it needs to be for everybody. It can't just be for artists. But I think one of the things, you know, about, we were chatting about, me and you were chatting about this before, what's happened in Britain, I don't want to see happening here, where if there's a reintroduction of third level education fees, the arts will die, really. For it, what will happen is it will become monocultural. So you only get people like, and they've talked about this in terms of acting, there's a lot of Benedict Cumberbatches and, you know, very, very well-heeled public schoolboys that get to go to RADA, pay 50,000 euros a year, £50,000 a year. You're told you're not allowed work while you're in art college because you have to dedicate all of your time. You know, if you're a poor working class kid from the north, they give out 5 scholarships maybe a year. You know, you have to be exceptional at the age of 18 to get one of those. So what happens is all of the art starts to come from one aspect. And the reason, you know, the post-war period in Britain had such a blooming of the arts was because it had a benevolent welfare system. It had art, you know, free tour level education. The Beatles, you know, went to art college. You know, you had people like Albert Finney and all these kind of working class artists. You don't get that now. I think NME even did a thing about it, saying that I think it was 70% of all the indie bands in the UK that had a record deal went to public school, but only 7% of the UK's population goes to public school, you know. So it starts to become skewed when you start to make tour level education transactional or fee paying, you know what I mean? It's just only people that can participate in the arts. The good thing about the arts in Ireland at the moment is because of free tour level education, and hat tip to Labour and Fine Gael for doing that, you have people from diverse backgrounds, you know, going to college, getting degrees in the arts, just taking their time, because nobody's going to take an arts degree if you reintroduce tour level education fees. Because when you come out of college, you are expected, again, you've internalized those market values, you hit the ground running, you have to make money in order to pay back your fees. You don't get the opportunity as an artist to loaf around for 10 years in your 20s and think about what to make or what to create or how to be creative. You have to become productive. And, you know, so...
We were talking to Lenny Abramson, and at first when we spoke to him, he did make the point that he was, you know, he had a reasonably well privileged background and an upbringing that allowed him to go, actually, I'd like to try and make films. You know, like, get your arse back into college and finish your degree. No, I think I'll try the films, you know. And he was very conscious of that. But, you know, I think of yourself and Stephen Jones out of Tala and coming out. And what were you thinking then, like in Tala, that I want to actually do spoken word poetry?
I think, you know, I was an actor really first and a playwright. Kind of the spoken word poetry kind of came from the plays that I was writing. And people would say that there's poetry within these plays. And what happened was the poetry then was isolated and kind of like released online. As videos. So then kind of people would just know me if they go to the theatre as a playwright and an artist, you know, that kind of way. And then they'd see they'd see my poems or whatever, and then go, well, are you a poet? You know, so I kind of, spoken word poetry is something that I didn't even know it was spoken word poetry until someone kind of would go, that's spoken word poetry. And like, oh, is it? All right.
Well, I suppose, you know, when you're going around marathon sports in the square looking for your Nike Air Maxes, you weren't going
to
be
talking to people, you know, inspirationally, and doing it with this kind of husky voice. And
if I gave you 24 hours to do to pick a couple of things you could do, whether it's, you know, through the Arts Council or through central government, what would be your big two things that you think you'd like to do?
It would have to be this isn't a dig at, like, the arts would have to be kind of like understood for what it is, arts for art's sake, and not this kind of co-opting of artists to become either agents of gentrification, agents of tourism, where essentially we have to justify our existence and our ability to offer anything to the state in how much we offer to vintners and hotels. So if they can get away from that kind of idea that we, like, I think with the gathering and, you know, the 1916 rising celebrations, they kind of started with Creative Ireland. They went, oh, actually, people have a thirst for culture. They have a thirst for art. They have a thirst for seeing representations of themselves up on stage or in art. And I think politicians, they didn't see that as an expression of Ireland as a nation, or artists as contrarians that can both be exalt the nation and can also be subversive towards the nation.
Yeah,
they seen it as us as being agents of advertising, to kind of advertise to the world that, here, look at us, austerity worked and we've come out the other side of it. So when they see the arts, they don't see us as, they don't see it as art for art's sake. And also, they're a bit suspicious of artists, because whilst there is no kind of edict that comes down from on high that you won't get money if you make something that challenges the state or is subversive, there's certainly a tacit understanding amongst artists that maybe you won't get that money if you are vocal or vocally disdainful of a government decision. I think what's happening is the artists constantly kind of go through this loop where we go, this time it's going to be different. And in fairness, the National Campaign for the Arts and other people, we've engaged with every government that's come in. And it is the scorpion and the frog, the chicken and the fox things. Like, this time it's going to be different. And we get halfway across the river and then they sting us. And we're like, we knew this was going to happen. We knew they were going to renege on all of the promises that they made.
It is the most put to me question whenever we talk to you is that, you know, as someone who is thought of as, you know, active and vocal and, you know, you're conscious of not making this political. Do you feel that there is a price put on that in the wider terms of your ability to work?
Oh yeah, like I was told, like, by people, like, not to be political, you know, that it will hurt revenue streams, and it has done. There's no kind of like two ways about it, you know what I mean? Like, you know, things, people have to know that if you're going to be working with them, that you're not a nutter, you know, this kind of way. Like, and there's a kind of thing that we say, we exalt people that will kind of speak truthfully in this country, but we don't, because there's a fear, there's a kind of like a thing in their chest that, like, we're giving you a live mic here and we're letting you go on live television. Don't say anything mad. But also, and I've said this before as well, with artists and with kind of people, there's an aspect of, they will almost want self-immolation on television or radio. He's a mad bastard. Give him the microphone. He'll set fire to himself on television or on radio, like, you know, by saying something mad and burn his career down. And when I say something mad, I mean just be critical of a particular facet of the government of the day. And I think in a country where that didn't happen for many years, if it does happen, people are like, oh, we can, you know what I mean? People get kind of shocked almost. They're like, I can't believe you said that. And I said, well, why wouldn't you say something like that? I said I was respectful and did my tone was okay. You know what I mean? Because tone is a huge thing in Ireland. Tone is usually code for accent, you know. It's like, you don't like the tone you're using. It's like, you don't like the accent that's saying it to you. That's the problem. You don't like my accent. You don't like the fact that this uppity kind of person, you know what I mean? There's a kind of aspect of, you should be grateful, you know what I mean, of something, like, grateful for a lot of things.
You have one of the best performances I ever seen you give was when you did your piece on accents, about you slip into your mother and father lecturing you.
Yeah.
About
that's a show that, like, kind of, you know, isn't going to happen now. That was it was a show called Accents that I was writing with a musician, Talis. And it was kind of about both of us, you know, both of us talking about our accents and about how accents in Ireland inform who we are, you know, and it informs other people who we are in the same way houses do or your clothes do. You know, people make decisions or judgments on how you sound, you know. And my parents were, like, they came to see Riot, which the poem Heartbreak is from. And it was part of the Fringe Festival. It was in Merrion Square. It was lovely in it. You know, big kind of event. And it was expressly political, you know. It was overtly political, I should say. I was myself and Ponty Bliss, and we were both doing things and writing things and saying things that were political. And my mother and father did say to me, you know, well, my mom not so much, but my father was, like, you know, like, hey, go easy on that now. I was like, why? He said, I don't know, they'll get you. And, you know, so that's what that poem was about. It was called, like, Mom and Dad Are Worried, you know, and it's like, watch yourself or they'll get you. And, you know, it's not like you're going to get this. Like, look, Ireland is a brilliant country. It is a great country. I love being Irish. I love living here. Nobody's going to disappear me, like, you know what I mean? Like, for saying anything. But there is an understanding, I think, that, like, you know, don't be a troublemaker. Don't say that. Don't do that. If you want to get ahead, just keep your head down. Don't put it above the parapet. Because if you do, you're going to get yourself in trouble. So you need to, you know, you need to kind of be a bit more, what's the word, elliptical when you're speaking about politicians. Or maybe just, the thing is as well, unfortunately for me, the art happens a lot of the time behind closed doors. It happens in theatres, in dark spaces. So I made the misjudgment, is that the word? I misjudged that people who would know my theatre and know me as an artist or a poet or a playwright or an actor, they'd come to see me in a dark space talking about these things. And my mistake, I think, is kind of going, oh, well, of course people know I'm this type of person, and then going on live national television and being that person as well. And kind of, you know, not really understanding the way a lot of other artists do, a lot of other actors do that, you know, just keep your mouth shut, you know?
Yeah.
I'm kind of intrigued about your earlier analogy that politicians and actors are sort of coming from the same space.
Yeah.
But do you think that politicians are or have stolen a lot from acting, in that they weren't always coming from the same space, but now they act a lot more than they politic?
I think there was Oireachtas TV had a documentary about it recently. Anytime you put a camera on anything, you change it. You know, you study it, you change the nature of the thing, even if it doesn't know it's being recorded or whatever that famous quote is. And it's very much the same with politics. So public accounts committees wouldn't have been filmed prior to now. But they are. So, you know, there's always a sense of performance. And Brian Singleton, an old, not, he's not old, but he, my old professor, sorry, I'm just running this on the airplane, he writes in his book, it's about masculinity in theatre, the ability to deliver oratory and polemic was something that was the exclusive rights of professional classes prior to working class people entering things like the professional classes or acting. So barristers and solicitors or politicians, there was nothing wrong, you know, there was nothing to that. This was all part of their job, delivering arguments and doing so fluidly and delivering rhetoric or delivering speeches. So you would have to be a good orator in other, you know, countries and even in Ireland in order to bring people on your side, you know, can I? So I don't, if there is a sense of acting from politicians in the Dáil, it all makes for, you know, if they're getting their message across, it makes it better. You know what I mean? It's clinical and analytical. Yeah, I don't know. There definitely is a sense of acting to it. And I think the documentary I was watching about Bertie O'Hearn, he said he was talking about it, saying that he could hear other politicians through the wall rehearsing what they were going to say in the lower house when they went in, or in the Senate, you know. There could be an aspect as well to them all thinking that the nature of the internet has changed how they deliver oratory. Hmm. You know, are they going to get up there and give a, which is bad in itself, you know, like, because questions in the lower house don't become about questions. They become about them making speeches. So they ask the question and then they go on for a minute and a half afterwards, like,
because it can be clipped in for Twitter and used as a as something that they can say.
It's memeable. It's something that can be shared, and it becomes. It's not about the message. You know what I mean? Like, so, I think the public is a lot more kind of. They don't want it to turn into that British style thing where essentially it's about who's the best speaker. You know, Corbyn can't deliver the winning punch. It's like, gives a fuck. What are his policies? Can he, is he going to solve poverty? Is he going to reverse austerity? Oh, he can't give it, like, you know, a quippy, pithy one-liner to Boris Johnson. No one gives a bollocks. Well, the public doesn't, but the media do. So if the politicians are becoming more like actors, they're being encouraged to as well by the internet and by the media. You know, it's like, that was a great performance. Yeah. That's
how
what
we, it's how it we consume it as well. Yeah.
You know, yeah.
It's how we consume it. There's definitely an element of the Leinster House in our own, you know, speaking from our own area, that we speak about it as in terms of he's up today, he won today. This was as if you're watching Monday Night Football.
That was a killer blow. That was a good blow. That was a good kind of thing. But like then again, you know, like the recent kind of exchange between Mary Lou and Leo Varadkar was bizarre.
Yeah.
You know what
and
I mean?
And it was lauded by large parts, and you're going, really? But none of it was factually correct.
Yeah. And but lauded by either side. It was like either side kind of would go, you know, well, Leo did great, and someone say, Mary Lou did great. So, you know, it's kind of.
I kind of think that transition that some singers make into acting is very soon going to be repeated by politicians.
In Dune, like that. That's what Ivan Yates is.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's what Ivan Yates is. Like that's a politician who's become an actor.
Yeah.
You know, Senator Norris is always kind of an actor. He is a performer. But like the Senate is kind of, in a weird way, you know, the perfect place. Cannery, is that a word for, you know?
Avery,
that's the word. What's a cannery?
Oh, God. You're just lucky Lynn didn't dial in, Martin. Or
no, it didn't mean it like that, but you know what I mean? I think I'm quoting Pat Rabbit actually on that. You know, he was talking about, I think he was talking about Mick Wallace or something like that, and he said it was like an Avery, like these, I don't think, you know, I don't agree with him, like whatever, but he can be quite funny. He was saying about like, birds that have beautiful plumage and feathers, you know what I mean? How many of them can we do? And I think he was referring to Mick Wallace, which I kind of thought was kind of funny. And he said this Avery can only have one or two kind of exotic birds or something. So he was calling Mick Wallace an exotic bird.
Emmett, I have to actually ask you, because I've been asked to ask you, would you do a few lines from anything for us this evening, or are you?
I'm not going to do, no. Yeah. It's really cringy when you do that.
And I can hear your voice is not at it either.
It's not at it, no, because I was doing, I'm actually looking at these questions here. The Temple Bar one is on my Emmett Kieran Facebook page, and the recent one. It's on YouTube as well. Yeah, and it's a sister piece to the piece that I wrote for the Abbey, which is in part four of the Abbey's Dear Ireland campaign, which was a great idea as well. So you can see something in the Dear Ireland thing, which we were saying about the future of. I think there's going to be more things like that, and that was a really good idea as well, because they kind of cast the net quite wide. They gave 50 actors and 50 writers the opportunity to speak, you know, and do it. Like they could have went another way and just given. I think it was,
they're all available on YouTube as well, and they're fantastic. You were the only one who cast yourself as the lead, though.
Yeah, and I kind of that was because he's gonna kill me. My long time collaborator, I asked him, and he was like, "I have three kids and a gap." He's like, "I'm trying to be making your stupid bleeding films with you." You know, I said, "There's money in it." So what happened was, I actually I had to cast myself, but then I had to work in a write around. Because contractually, because again, this is state funding, they couldn't have a writer write an act and get both checks. Mm. So I had to write in a kind of joke about giving 500 quid to an editor. So that's in there as well, you know?
And so,
but then of course, like everyone was like, so you were kind of talking yourself. And it's like, I was like, yeah, it's like Nabokov's The Despair, like the double that he meets, you know? It's not, it's just because I basically wrote a two-hander and I couldn't get the other actor. So I had to cast myself doing both parts. You could tell people any old shite and they believe you.
Listen,
I meant to do all that. I meant to do that. That was it. It's Nabokov's despair. The double. There you go.
Can I open up for a couple of questions before we wrap up? Is that okay? If anybody wants to come off mute there, I'm unfreezing. I see DJ. Well, DJ, you want to ask a question?
Yeah, Tony. Thanks a million, Emmett, for giving us time to listen to you there. But I think you, I just want to ask you about the point you made about funding the arts there at the beginning. And you talked about, you know, the leaders giving, saying that they'd raise it by a certain percentage, and then like a
7% year on year for the next 10 years. Yeah.
Yeah. And a 10-year action plan.
Yeah.
I just think there's that resonates with so many other parts of Irish society. Like I work in healthcare, care, a 10-year action plan. And after a year, nothing's followed up on. The implementation plan isn't implemented. So it brings me back to an old echo chamber pod, Tony and Martin, with Niall O'Toole before the general election about implementation deficiency disorder.
Yes.
That was a great line from that. And I just thought it was a very good point, because I've literally worked this week on how do we get the cancer unit in Waterford up to speed on Sláinte care where it should be throughout the COVID pandemic. And you just can't do it because the political will isn't there.
Is they make the 10-year plans like Sláinte care, and I know arts is it's the lowest fruit, hanging fruit, whatever. But I listened to some of the pack around the time of, I can't remember what it was, but it was the ex head of the HSC was saying, you know, and I think he wrote about it in the Sunday Business Post. He said, we can't plan for mental health in this country if you're only giving us a budget of 12 months. Now, we understand things can change. You know, God laughs when you make plans like this crisis, for example. But the healthcare system cannot make plans for the future, either in recruitment or whatever it needs to do, if it only knows that it's going to have 12 months of funding. So I think to DJ's point, it's the same for health, it's the exact same for the arts. And the really galling thing was, like, you know, that 10-year plan, they said about that in like 2016, 2017, and we got it this year. And it was nothing. Like, it was just a really wishy-washy kind of 5 years into the plan, the implementation, you know. So they make all of these things, they make all of these promises, but then the political will just isn't there. And at the time, it was actually used as a political football between Coveney and Varadkar to try and, you know, the liberal Fine Gael voters who actually do engage in the arts, they wanted to say that they were serious about the arts. They liked the arts and they went to the arts and they consumed them, because there's always been a kind of an aspect. I remember reading an Examiner, they said this thing, Fine Gael's kind of almost, the arts are something they don't really understand and they don't want to know anything about it, and they don't think it will play well to a lot of their constituents. You know what I mean? That money goes to kind of like wacky liberals in Dublin doing, or Cork or Galway, or, you know, making subversive, odd, weird, you know what I mean? Like art, you know, that kind of way. So it's, they've always kind of kept it at, sorry, they've always kept it at arm's length.
Yeah.
Claire O'Connor, sorry, DJ. Claire O'Connor's there, wanted to ask a question as well. Claire.
Hey, Emmett, come here. I think the accent stuff is fascinating. I talk a million miles an hour. So anytime I do any media, I really have to make an effort to slow down.
Yeah.
But I feel like it changes my accent and I kind of overpronounce things. And then I feel a bit guilty about that. Do you get that? Because obviously as an actor, you have to be, like, does your accent change and do you feel guilty that you're not actually representing?
I
have people accuse me of being middle class and I'm
Well, look, this is the thing. It's there's a load to unpack there. We got time? Hold on, anyway. No, because it is something that I've worked on films as an accent coach. I studied phonetics in college. So I've studied accents and how to teach people how to do accents. And what happens is that what's happening when you do that and when you're in those interview situations is a thing called accommodation. So it's something that happens with the slow part and the fast thinking part of your brain. You make a judgment call on somebody whether or not they're a threat based on how they sound and they look. So what happens sometimes, if you want somebody to like you, you will modulate your accent towards their accent, but you don't actually realize that they're doing the same thing. They modulate their accent towards yours too. So both accents can kind of change in whatever the situation is. So what your base accent is, whatever comes out of your mouth when you're angry or when you're speaking to your social grouping that you went to school with. So that's what your real accent is, because you're not using the slow part of your brain to deliberate about what you're going to say. So words just come out. And if you're a fast thinker, like you are, you know, fast talker, your words are coming out. So your accent will probably stay the same, you know. But also, it's just a thing about communication. Dublin Old School as a film can't be watched in America without the subtitles. And Screen International said it was impenetrable because they couldn't get the accents. So and when it showed at the London Film Festival, there was more laughs on the second night when they had the subtitles for the for people that had hearing or you know, people that are neurotypical, you know, help staff subtitles when they're watching the film. I noticed in the cinema that people just got more of the jokes because they could hear us, they could understand us. So for me, it's always about communication. And what will happen is somebody might go, you changed your accent, you're not real. And again, that's another thing that's about this kind of fetishization of authenticity. You're not the real deal. You're not really from Tala. You're not really working class. You're not really that. You're not really that thing that you make the art about or that thing that you talk about. And it's like, get a fucking grip, man. If I talked as fast or as quickly or as, you know, as I do with the people I grew up with, it would be impenetrable. So it is your accent. And this is the thing I'm always saying, one of the aspects of the show, and I've talked about this on other shows as well, you know, your accent is indicative of who you are, who your family is. It's passed down to you through generations. It changes through the generations. It changes with style, with where you live. It changes with each kind of new generation that comes along. But it's representative of your family, of your culture, of your country, of your town, of who you are and everything you are. So you should always be proud of it. But sometimes we do have to kind of like, you know, round out the T's or whatever, or tap them in order for people to understand it. And then there's the extreme of it where people do this really weird Dublin thing where they start to talk like that and they pronounce all of the ends of their sentences and they sound like lunatics. So I always try to find a happy medium. So what I do is I slow down. But by virtue of you slowing down when you speak, your accent will change. You know, the accommodation thing will kick in. And you will try to accommodate you to speak.
Last question I'm going to take is from David. You there, David?
Yeah, I am. Yeah.
And you keep it short. I know what you're like.
I will, yeah. No, just go back to your question earlier, talking about the arts there. Yeah. Do you think more needs to be done in schools to kind of reshape the social thinking of it? Like coming from someone that's a household that my mother would have been driving on, oh, there's no money in that. Choose this college course. Go and do civil engineering as opposed to computers or something, you know. I think more needs to be done to kind of reshape the social thinking of what arts can bring and the people should go chase what they actually want to do and what they might love.
Yeah, like, I mean, that was kind of the I think that's what people thought they wanted Creative Ireland to be, which was the initiative that was set up by after 2016. But ultimately, I remember someone said, they go, this is just, everybody's going to get a free box of chalk and a recorder in schools. So it's grand if you tell people or kids, young people, that the arts are important. But if you make the arts or the world in which they're about to enter into hostile for artists, they're not going to, you know, want to live in that world. And what's happened in Europe is they have made their economies places that are not hostile to become artists. So in France, for example, you know, if you can prove for certain amount that if you can improve your credentials as an artist, you will receive a kind of benevolent form of the dole, which is what they tried to roll out. Fine Gael tried to roll out 3 years ago, but it was a disaster. It didn't work for people. So what happens is people have to make decisions. You know, mothers a lot of the time, you know, they're in the arts, and then if they have a baby, they have to leave the arts. You know what I mean? So the benevolent dole was a thing that was supposed to try and keep people involved and keep people doing it. You know, but that mindset, I think, is everybody's parents have that. I do not want you to be poor, because artists have always been poor. But a lot of European countries, like, you know, Russia as well still does it, like, and you know, Eastern European countries like Bulgaria, like Romania, Bulgaria do it. You know what I mean? They have state institutions that try and France especially and Spain. Ireland at the minute is at the bottom of the table in terms of art spending per capita for the whole of Europe. And it's weird because, you know, we give the country, you know, what they call soft power. Kenny gave Barack Obama a book of Hawaiian folklore children's tales for his daughters that was written by Pádraig Colum, an Irish artist, a very clever person in a professor in Trinity on folklore, seeing that McCollum had written, or Colum had written this, and knew obviously that Barack Obama was from Hawaii. And, you know, Enda Kenny went over and gave them a first edition and, you know, got this cultural capital that was given to him by Ireland's artists. You know, he didn't go over there and give Barack Obama a block of cheese, you know? So they know we are worthy in that there's money to be made and there's culture and there is cash to be made. There's capital to be made in art, but it's usually artists that don't get it. So it's more about kind of us creating a space where artists don't give up being artists after 2 or 3 years, that they're encouraged to be artists continually over a long period of time. And at the moment, with the funding issue with the Arts Council, or what has happened in the past with project funding, institutions, you know, long-term planning for the arts can't happen. So it's you either get one thing that's successful or you go and get a job, you know, because you're seen as a drain on society until they want to actually consume something that you do. Book, TV series, radio play, novel, you know, people go, I'm not paying for the art. And it's like, well, you're probably experiencing the arts right now, this podcast, this audiobook, this thing you're listening to. You know, people are consuming art all the time, but they don't think it is. They think art is just something that happens in closed door spaces with, you know, posh people that have weird accents, you know.
Emma, can I wrap it up with the words, the words of that you said your father said to you? Would you not try to be a nobody? Stop trying to be a somebody. Not be a nobody.
Sorry, someone had a great question, McClare. Always about accents, yeah. So yeah, that's it, is it?
That's it, guys. Listen, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it. Good day. And look, hope you're getting settled in now after your.
Look at that bookcase. look how there it is. That's, we've got 2 desks now, so super large.
Thanks for joining us, folks. I'm going to hang on and bash Martin for a minute if anybody wants to say anything. But Emmett, we let you go. Thanks for that.
Thanks, guys. Thanks, everyone. Cheers. Thank you. Bye-bye.